When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Adam Woodward.
I'm Sophie Monks Kaufman.
On the show this week, artist Nan Golding sees the future and all the beauty and the bloodshed, and we'll be talking to the director, Laura Poitras. Spielberg comes of age in The Fablemans, and on Film Club, Nan Golding reappears in downtown New York in Betty Gordon's Variety. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So I think we've actually managed so far on the podcast to not get too into like award season discourse, but I think we're going to have to this week because it was Oscar nominations day before yesterday when the episode comes out. Adam, any things that you were kind of pleasantly surprised by?
Well, you've asked the wrong person there, I'm afraid, because I don't tend to generally pay much interest to the Oscars. But I will say, having only just recently caught up with Sarah Polley's Women Talking, I was quite pleased to see her nominated for Best Picture and also Best Adapted Screenplay. Although it is a bit baffling, and I don't really know, there doesn't really seem to be much rhyme or reason to this, but I'm not really sure how you can be nominated for those two awards and then not be nominated for Best Director. I think the lack of like female representation in the director category is a bit odd. But she's got a good shout, I think, at least at one of those. And I think, you know, these awards kind of mean a lot to people who are like invested in them in terms of the prognosticators and I guess like the trades and people within the industry obviously care a lot. And I think if she wins something and it means she gets to make more films of the caliber of Women Talking, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, I mean, Sarah Polley is really one of our great talents, and we haven't had a huge filmography from her. So if this kind of leads to loads more being greenlit, then, you know, all praise be the golden statuette of the Oscars. But yeah, we also have All the Beauty and the Bloodshed got nominated, which I think some people thought maybe it might be a bit too edgy. Sophie, I imagine that pleased you very much.
Well, I, like Adam, I found it very difficult to feel any kind of way about the Academy Awards, even though I do rationally recognise that it can be a very, very good thing in terms of that filmmaker then being able to make more films. So for me, the sport is not so much the Oscars, but watching other people reacting to the Oscar news. I'm like, wow, look at that. Vibes are kicking off online. People have views, their opinions. I see them. I just don't seem to have any myself.
I'm the same, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of find them more interesting in terms of what does this say about the current state of Hollywood than like, I mean, there's no notion to me that this is actually the selection of the best films, really, or the best performances. It's pretty arbitrary. But yeah, still devastated that Alice Diop's Saint-Omer wasn't recognised. And yeah, Gina Prince-Bythewood is clearly not happy. She's been tweeting up a storm about the disrespect that black women get. Yeah.
So The Woman King, which I must admit I haven't seen, I thought when that came out, the kind of hype around that film suggested it was gonna kind of like sustain that momentum. So I actually find it really interesting that like films which are sort of, you know, whether or not audiences see them, like the films that have the kind of critical backing and the sort of, you know, industry backing, I find it interesting how sometimes they just kind of drop off a cliff when it comes to within a few weeks or months of the actual ceremonies. And like on the flip side of that, how suddenly something out of nowhere, I mean, like Coda last year was a good example, right? But even this year, sort of Andrea Riseborough and that whole bizarre campaign to get her nominated for a film like no one's seen, but, you know, which I guess a few people reviewed quite positively. But that I find a really interesting thing. Like, it's all just a big game basically, isn't it?
Yes. And actually Layla's point, I think, is very astute about it's what it says about contemporary Hollywood. And I think it's very interesting, actually, that All the Beauty and the Bloodshed has been doing so well from its birth at the Venice Film Festival till now. I guess it's that kind of, in the same way that people respond to Ruben Östlund films that pinion the wealthy by being like, ha ha ha, we're in on the joke, therefore we can't be responsible. I think it's a similar thing, even though it's such a different type of film with All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. It's like, oh my God, we like totally sympathize with these poor victims of like American injustice. We therefore are the good guys. So I think there's an element of that, like kind of, in a way it makes you feel good to root for these plucky underdogs. And so maybe that's like part of its appeal to the Academy voters. This is mere prognostication.
Yeah, but then you get something like She Said about the Harvey Weinstein investigation. Again, a film I haven't seen. I assume that that would do quite well at this sort of thing in a sort of self-congratulatory, we got rid of him, look at us, we solved the problem. But maybe it was a bit too close to home. A lot of those voters will have worked with Weinstein.
I was going to say, yeah, a bit too close to the bone maybe. But I think Sophie's right. There's a kind of like altruism in Hollywood, which tends to kind of prevail in these situations. And you get people wanting to kind of put something on a pedestal, which, you know, in this case is fully deserved, but something that kind of reflects well on the voting body, I think is always in with a shout.
Yeah, exactly. Like good PR. It's good PR to root for this film. And we would know, we put it on our cover.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm not surprised that kind of The Fablemans has done so well, because I just think that there is an element of like people wanting to be like, oh, aren't the movies grand? Isn't this this incredible business that we're in, that we're providing for the world? But yeah, we'll get on to whether or not that's any good very shortly. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our City HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. The Fablemans is loosely based on Spielberg's childhood. Growing up in post-World War II era Arizona, a young man, Sammy Fableman, discovers a shattering family secret. The film explores how the power of movies helps us to see the truth about each other and ourselves. So, Adam, like, I think a lot of The Fablemans depends on, like, you have to buy into the myth of Steven Spielberg as being this, you know, great artist, great director. Is that your relationship with him?
Well, I don't know that that's a myth. But I see what you mean. I mean, I think you have to kind of be invested to some degree, even though he and Tony Kushner, his co-screenwriter on this film, have sort of ostensibly distanced Spielberg from the characters by kind of calling them the Fablemans, and that there are elements of like artistic license in telling his own story. But no, I think it depends really how much you're kind of invested in like latter day Spielberg looking and revisiting at his own career from this perspective. Because I mean, pretty much since Ready Player One, has been reflecting, I guess, on his own legacy. I mean, that film is very much like, look at all this stuff I've made and look at how it's being recycled and manipulated and put into these other contexts. And I think that's very much like an artist kind of grappling with his own legacy. And he is, you know, in the sort of twilight of his career. And I think The Fablemans feels like a film that could only be made by someone with the distance from that part of his own life, but also just the legacy and the sort of amazing career that he's had like behind him. It is obviously like a very personal film, even though he's kind of changed the characters' names. Like if you kind of read anything about his childhood and you know anything about like his parents, for example, I think it's like pretty faithful to his story and a lot of the events that happened. It ends with this amazing scene, which I won't kind of spoil. There's a scene where he kind of meets an old Hollywood legend, and Spielberg has like told this anecdote 100 times before, but kind of seeing it brought to life on screen in the way that it's done is just like, I don't know, that really kind of made me believe again in like the power of the movies, you know, and as much as that is a kind of corny cliche thing. And I think this is a film about obviously a boy falling in love with a hobby, basically what starts as a hobby that quickly becomes a life choice, like a career direction, falling in love with this art form. But it's also, I think, dealing with the other side of that, which is sometimes the isolation that brings, or the difficulty, like when you're obsessed about something, as Spielberg is about making movies, you know, I think it can be quite kind of like alienating and frustrating, and there's all these other emotions that come with it. Like it has an impact a little bit on his relationship with like his father, who's much more kind of academic, And I suppose in that generation, it would have been very kind of common to sort of follow in the footsteps of one of your parents in that way. But he goes the route set out for him by his mother, who's much more artistic. But yeah, for me, that this film is like, it's a great coming of age film on its own terms. I mean, take Spielberg out of the equation and just, I think the story is really captivating. But it also, in the context of like Spielberg's career, unlocks so much stuff about his other films. I mean, you kind of watch this and it kind of crystallizes a lot of stuff, I think, that he's done in the past and films that he's made and his preoccupations, his kind of thematic interests. I think, you know, you watch something like Close Encounters and the mothership landing and you think about that in the context of like his parents being a computer scientist and a pianist and knowing that they had this kind of failure or struggle to communicate, and then think about that scene and like the way the kind of humans and the aliens end up like making contact is like, for me, that was like a proper like mind expanding moment, like realizing that. And then also, you know, in Temple of Doom, a lot of monkeys die, right? I mean, that's another another thing that you could probably glean from this film, like the monkey character that his mother adopts is quite a funny and again true to life, like that actually they did actually have that pet monkey. But you can kind of trace back like Spielberg's hatred of monkeys from that.
My mum actually really has always said this thing that she thinks that the happiest woman who ever lived must have been Steven Spielberg's mother, because like, how nice that your son becomes Steven Spielberg, and what a thing to be proud of. Obviously, it's a bit more complicated than that. In terms of performances for you, there's been some kind of criticism, Sophie, of like casting non-Jewish actors in these roles as his parents. I mean, it's his parents, so it's his prerogative. But what did you make of Michelle Williams and Paul Dano?
Well, Michelle Williams is obviously performing a person who is performing in her life. So she's this very larger-than-life theatrical presence who's very mannered. And, you know, this is not just Michelle Williams overacting. This is conscious creative choice, because her character is trying to put up this facade of being someone who is alive when she's kind of dying inside. So, yeah, so there's like a sound logic behind it. But for me, the film just wasn't really anchored enough in its emotional themes for me to really feel for her. Indeed, to feel very much for little Sammy Fableman. And, you know, much like little Sammy Fableman, my relationship with Steven Spielberg has gone from me as a child being like absolutely dazzled, this is the best filmmaker in the world, to now feeling a little bit more like a little bit of a more adult disillusionment. You know, I've put him on a pedestal and he doesn't belong there, and I've got a bit more of a conflicted relationship now with his films. Yeah, including this one, which just, for all its metatextual intrigue in terms of the light it sheds on both his life and the films he's made, just for me emotionally, that it didn't really land in a way that I was really, really hoping that it would. I don't know. How do you feel, host Layla Latif?
I kind of came in assuming that it would be a little bit sentimental to me, this kind of tradition ever since Roma of these filmmakers kind of telling their own coming of age stories and then throwing in a bit of, oh, ain't the movie's grand. I think I was expecting Empire of Light and I actually enjoyed it a lot more than that. I couldn't really resist it in many ways. Like, there's something so sincerely inspiring, I suppose, for the journey of like this young Jewish,
you sort of winced when you said sincerely inspiring, like, oh my god, was, yeah, I really inspired? I was.
I know, my cold black heart melted. But yeah, I kind of couldn't fully resist this idea of like, oh god, you know, a little bit the American dream of like, if you've got talent and you work hard, then someone out of nowhere with, you know, basically no connections can become a 27-year-old who makes Jaws, or the guy in 1993 who made both Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. I mean, it is a kind of miracle.
But I think it's also about how he had to struggle. And I put that in kind of, you know, caveat that with the fact that he was from a quite like fairly prosperous family and grew up in kind of quite cosseted sort of suburbia. But it's not like he was just sort of thrown into the movie industry and got the opportunity to make Jaws. Like, you know, he sort of earned his stripes coming up through the industry. And I think it's just this creative impulse, this creative obsession and this drive that he had, which kind of is explained in this film, that really kind of got him there. And ultimately, like, his talent and his determination is what's created Spielberg, the kind of myth. But yeah, I mean, I get what Sophie's saying about maybe the film not always landing emotionally. I think there's some scenes definitely that work better in that sense. There's a really nice scene with young Sammy and his mother, where she is, you know, he's the oldest of the children. He's got like younger sisters. They're very much kind of like on the fringes really of this film. But you know, he kind of realizes before anyone else in the family that there's this inevitable separation about to happen, basically. And his mother is deeply unhappy and in love with someone else. And he kind of has to deal with that and confronts her basically over it. And I think that's a really beautiful scene. That was probably the scene that affected me most in the film. And then there's a really great scene later on where Sammy's kind of made a film to show at his high school prom, and there's a sort of classic jock character who has been kind of bullying Sammy throughout, and he, even though Sammy shows him in this like amazing heroic light up on screen, this character becomes very uncomfortable with that. And I think that was just a kind of like quite a revealing and intriguing little tidbit of like the, you know, the relationship between an artist, a filmmaker, and the people that they choose to put up on screen and how they choose to portray them. And that told me quite a lot about Spielberg's trajectory and his skill, basically, because he's kind of manipulating a situation to paint someone in a super positive light. But there's always this sense of like, he's kind of doing it to get one over on him in his own way. But I just found that quite a kind of clever and, as I say, intriguing moment.
That was actually one of the most interesting scenes in the film. And I realise I only half answered Layla's question, because you asked about Michelle Williams and Paul Dano. And Paul Dano gives almost the opposite type of performance to Michelle Williams. It's incredibly buttoned up, incredibly restrained. And he gets his moment, which is another one of the film's strongest scenes, like right towards the end, which is like quite painful in a way, because it's just, you know, that phrase, the father is child of the man. Like, it's got to a point where Sammy Fableman is in a much more powerful position in his life than his father. And it just, the way that scene unfolds is really exquisitely played, I think, by Paul Dano. You know, he doesn't oversell what his character has lost or his diminished stature in life. He's just there, like, still rooting for his kid. But you just feel that this man who once was, you know, the father, is now just some guy in some pretty anonymous apartment just struggling to get by. That was a really, really strong scene as well, because I've been reflecting on sort of the Steven Spielberg effect, and, you know, I don't want to put a target on my back or anything by saying anything too dismissive. You know, like, I grew up with Steven Spielberg, loving Steven Spielberg. I put Jurassic Park on my greatest films of all time for the sight and sound ballot. Like, this man is an incredible, incredible filmmaker. But I think maybe his films, for me, work the most when there's some kind of, like, fantastical element, or, you know, in the case of Schindler's List, there's some kind of extraordinary external factor that is somehow holding up the reasons for his broad strokes type of emotional storytelling. And I think in something that's a bit smaller, like a domestic drama, somehow all those notes don't come together for me. But there were still moments in The Fablemans that really, really were, like the two we just discussed. And also the opening stretch where tiny little Sammy Fableman goes to the cinema for the first time and sees The Greatest Show on Earth, and then comes home and then is given a train track. All this stuff that is like Spielberg, you know, working with these huge themes, that's where he knows exactly what he's doing. I feel that he's not necessarily the guy to go to for like the domestic miniature.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
I think that's very fair. It would be a spoiler, but yes, for me, top scene is the final one. And I think the way that it then plays with the advice that young Sammy Fableman gets in its kind of final shots was just absolutely delightful. But yeah, we should get some scores on this, because we've got some great other movies to get to. Sophie, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, see, I think one of the reasons I was underwhelmed was I came to this like expecting to see another one of my favourite Spielberg films ever. So I came in with a big five, and then it was a bit of a three for me. And then afterwards, I slumped out with my three.
Adam, what about you?
I was slightly more anticipating this with a bit more scepticism, maybe. I think probably a three, and that jumped to like a four, and probably a four in retrospect. And Sophie mentioned that scene that opens the film with a very young Sammy trying to recreate at home the train crash from The Greatest Show on Earth. And the first film I saw at the cinema was Jurassic Park, and I distinctly remember going home and playing with my little toy dinosaurs. And not that that led to any kind of great love of like filmmaking, but I think there's something there that is a universal feeling of that first experience and that kind of formative falling in love with the movies. And you know, yes, it's corny and schmaltzy, but that got me. I'm a sucker for that stuff. So definitely kind of fours for the...
But hold up, Adam, can I just check, for the good of mankind, you're not working on some kind of dino theme park, are you currently?
Not currently, no.
All right.
But I wouldn't rule it out.
Okay.
Maybe this has rekindled my childhood obsession.
Okay, Layla, we need eyes on Adam at all times.
Okay, yeah. Everybody keep your dinosaur fossils to themselves, lest you extract some DNA and wreak havoc. But yeah, I think actually one of my first was also Jurassic Park. And I remember it came out, you know, back then they used to come out so much longer after they were out in America. So the build for Jurassic Park coming out was so huge. And yeah, I think I had quite a similar moment to young Sammy Fableman too. And how far the mighty have fallen. Look at the state of the current blockbuster. Look at the state of the Jurassic Park films. Crikey. Yeah, but I am probably with you, Adam, at about a 3, 4, 4. I think also those last few moments kind of saved it for me. I just found it kind of so irresistible to kind of not be quite inspired. And my dark, cynical heart wanted to feel good, and it did. But yeah, we should move on to a slightly more difficult subject. But before that, Little White Lies editor David Jenkins had the chance to talk to All the Beauty and the Bloodshed's director, Laura Protras. Better yet, he got to talk to her just a couple of hours after she learned of the film's Oscar nomination. So you can enjoy that chat now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
The first question I want to ask you is more of a general one about your instincts as a nonfiction filmmaker in particular. And when you're making movies, have you sort of developed an instinct for knowing when you have found a subject or a protagonist worthy of a treatment, of dedicating so much time and energy to?
Yeah, I do feel like, having made several films, that there is a certain common feeling that I have when I know that it's the right film, which doesn't mean that it makes the film easy, but there is a kind of obsession. And I felt that with every film that I've made, just like so drawn into the people I'm documenting. And most of my films have an element of following something happening in real time. And so in a way, the drama, you know, I'm experiencing the drama as I'm making the films. And I'm experiencing it through the eyes of the people that I document and who trust me. And that the feeling that I have is the feeling that then I try to translate for the audience. So if I'm not feeling all those things, you know, excited, moved, scared, you know, then I would have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, most of my films do look at people who are at some kind of a historical crossroads, and they're agents in those moments. They're not bystanders. They're not opinionators. They're like people who are doing something. Mm-hmm. And that something is in many cases leading to really meaningful change. And so if that's Edward Snowden or Julian Assange or Dr. Riyadh in Iraq, they're all people sort of taking action and oftentimes taking action against injustice. And so that those are the kind of themes that I keep circling back to over and over, and that I find, yeah, it's like I can't say no to. I'm completely compelled by these narratives. And so if I have those feelings, then I feel, okay, so then my job is, how do I translate them? And the answer to that is a long, messy process that takes years and has, you know, lots of highs and lows and lots of doubts. But ultimately, I often find that like those initial feelings that I have about a project and those instincts align with the finished film, even though how you get there is always hard for me at least.
So you're talking about this idea of there is a kind of this present tense aspect of pretty much all of your films. And in All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, we have footage of Nan Goldin's protests against the Sackler family and their involvement in arts institutes around the world. What's the feeling of filming that material in terms of thinking about how it's going to translate into film and knowing whether you have got that drama or that story there?
You know, like with any kind of drama that you experience, the truth is you don't know what's going to happen next. That's what drama is, right? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And so with this film, and we didn't know, you know, if they would be successful. Would the institutions, the museums stop taking money? Would they take down a name? Nan began the film and they documented the early actions and I joined later. And so when I joined, there was... That's when, like, the guy who was spying on them, they found the, you know, the private investigator. And now they have some guy up, you know, following Megan, walking her dog and taking photographs. I mean, that's really creepy. And so, like, we were legitimately all really nervous. And so, like, all the kind of feelings of uncertainty that happen when you make films that you don't know where they're going, you know, that's what creates, for me, like, the pull. There is a certain pull to it. And this film also has a lot of interviews and it goes, you know, it has a lot of things that happened in the past, but I tried to emphasize that kind of present tenseness, even though if it's something is in the past. So for instance, the remarkable footage of David Wanarovich in his apartment as he's battling the sort of controversy that happens when he was collaborating with Nan on this art show, Witnesses Against Our Vanishing. To me, that footage like has such a pulse and a heartbeat because there is somebody in the room filming David as the phones are ringing off the hook and the, you know, the newspapers are full of attacks of him and his writing. And again, that has this kind of aliveness that I really search for in all of my films, like to bring that forward. And for me, one of the great thrills about this film was like the discoveries that happened through the archival materials. And we worked with an incredible team of archive producers led by Shanti Avergan and also Olivia Streisand. And they would find this footage that was like time travel, you know, province town. Anyway, I keep returning to the films that you get a sense of being there in the moment when the stakes are really high. Because oftentimes when you talk to people about something that's in the past, you know, you feel like it's already been, you know, it already has a sense of closure.
Do you recall your first encounter with Nan's work? Do you recall the kind of situation around it and your impressions at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I first encountered Nan's work through her book, The Ballad of Sexual Dependency. I was living in San Francisco in the late 80s. I was studying filmmaking and I had a roommate. She was a photographer and she moved from Boston and she had a copy of The Ballad of Sexual Dependency, one of the early copies of it. And I just remember being, you know, completely blown away. Like this was like a different type of visual storytelling. Not only was it the photographs themselves incredibly cinematic, you know, the sense of character and mise-en-scène, but then also the way that Nan sequences her photographs, that is its own kind of visual storytelling. So yeah, completely blown away. And at the time I was working as a projectionist in San Francisco and I never saw her do this slideshow, but there were people I worked with who worked with Nan when she was coming in with her carousel. So I did that live, but I know people who worked with her and they have great stories. So her work has been part of my vocabulary and reference points for as long as I've been a filmmaker.
For me, one of the most remarkable things about the film is Nan's narration, the way she intones it. I mean, it's this remarkable thing in and of itself. It feels key to the emotional power of the film. Could you talk a bit about how you recorded the narration?
I totally agree in terms of like the emotional power of the film. It's I think it's more of a dialogue. The audio was recorded over the course of a year and a half, many, many sit-down interviews. And when I did the very first one, I had the same feeling that you just described, a sense of like, there's something not just about the words she uses and the eloquence and the sort of, I don't know, the way that she gets to a point, but also like the sound of her voice, the sound of the pauses, all of it was like so evocative emotionally and had all those elements of being in the moment, being present. And that's what I'm always searching for as a filmmaker. Like I don't want to hear something that I feel like I've heard before. you know, or that I feel like it's been told before. I want to feel that it feels alive and feels present. And I felt that when I did the very first interview with her, and I knew that the quality that she brought to it would resonate with the quality of her photographs. But to put them side by side was going to be really special. And so we did many, many interviews. It's not like we had a script. It was a dialogue, and there were interviews. A lot of my questions, of course, we pulled out. There were a couple sections where she was like, okay, I want to go back, you know, do more interviews or maybe clarify something. But mostly the voiceover was done in dialogue with the man. And we would only focus on one thing at a time. She liked to know what we were talking about. So I'd say, okay, I want to talk about Witnesses Against Our Vanishing and David Wonderovich. And so she knew ahead of time. Like, and so that allowed us to be like really get into minutia around that history and maybe find new vocabulary to talk about it. I think one of the dangers as a filmmaker doing interviews is people have the narrative that they've told before, and then they repeat the narrative. And I don't know why I use this metaphor, but because I'm not a skier, but like if the tracks are already there, you can go to the tracks that, you know, like that have already been laid, or like you could go someplace where there are no tracks, you know, and like how can we go to the place where there aren't tracks? That maybe feels a little bit more scary.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Laura. And congrats again on the nomination, and let's fingers crossed for the victory.
It's great to be in the UK, and I just want to do a shout out to like the museums, because it was the UK were the first to take down to stop taking Sackler money. So yeah. The National Portrait Gallery and Tate, they led the way. So
All the Beauty and the Bloodshed follows the life of artist Nan Goldin and her eventual role in the downfall of the Sackler family, the pharmaceutical dynasty whose name appeared in many of the world's finest art institutions, but was responsible for flooding the American population with OxyContin and subsequently for the opioid epidemic's unfathomable death toll. I mean, it really is an unfathomable death toll. I think we're at about kind of 600,000 people that are victims of this. It's a very painful film to watch, but I think it's one that you really connected with straight away, Sophie. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, that was nearly 6 months ago now at Venice. I gave it an A+ in my review for IndieWire. Subsequently spoke to Nan Goldin and Laura Poitras and have hyped it to every single person that's asked me what's a good film that's coming out. And then I just had this question, have I misremembered how great it is? But then I rewatched it last night and it was exactly as powerful as I recalled. I don't know. It's just like, it's just doing so many things at once on a storytelling level. And yet somehow it is also incredibly coherent emotionally. It's got this arc, and its emotional coherence is somehow also enriches storytelling, because it's the grief that is within it is like a way of paying respect to all the people that have died in the opioid crisis, preventable tragedies, and also to Nan Goldin's sister Barbara, to whom the film is dedicated. So I think like that's why I think it's such a monumental achievement, the fact that it tells so many stories. You know, it tells the story of Nan Goldin, of her childhood in suburbia and how she lived in various queer communities and then came to be an activist for a group called PAIN. It also tells the story of the ACT UP protests when people were dying of AIDS in the 1980s. And it tells the story of the communities that Nan belonged to. It tells so many different stories at such an interesting pace, and it also tells the story of the rise of the Sackler family and how they made their name in reputable circles by artistic donations, and until recently lots of art galleries across the world bore their name. But simultaneously, through their company Purdue Pharma, they distributed OxyContin to America, and they not only distributed it, they marketed it. Poitras finds this advert where you have a doctor being like, guys, you're all worried about taking OxyContin because you fear it's addictive, but don't worry, it isn't. So, you know, the absolute impunity of their behaviour, like the film is full of grief, but also fury, and it really exposes the Sackler family. So it's got all these different elements. And, you know, listening to myself speak, it sounds so busy, but it's somehow seamlessly structured in a way that it all flows beautifully. But then it's also like this fireball at the centre of like grief and anger, and also like love, like great love and tenderness for all the people that have died. And Nan herself, as a sort of atlas holding up this world, manages to contain all of these stories, all of these feelings, and she's still here. And that adds this kind of extraordinary emotional power to the film. So yeah, that's why I think it's just phenomenal.
I think it's worth saying that it's narrated by Nan, and her way with words is absolutely astonishing. I mean, even the title comes from something which we won't reveal, but it's just an incredibly beautifully narrated thing, which is less interesting than your insights, but I didn't want to point that out.
That's a really good point. And also the other thing I'd be absolutely remiss not to point out is so much of it is founded upon Nan's photography and slideshows. So it's using this very original archive material as well to tell the story. So Nan Golden is known primarily as a photographer, but her chosen way of exhibiting her work is actually through these slideshows set to music. And that those become these living things, and she would never show the same slideshow twice. She would edit it in a slightly different way, move it around, set it to different music. And in a way, this film is like the final form of this constant process of re-editing, because it itself is it's not just the slideshow, the film, but the slideshows are very prominent in it. And so you have all these extraordinary works of art within this bigger work of art. So there's just so much artistry to it. And like, her photos are so raw, and they just take you back to the people and places that, and you get these little glimmers for like a split second as you see them on screen of these people who recur in photos, and you're like, who are they? What became of them? So there's just, I think there's just so much life force within it. But at some point I will have to stop raving about how great it is and let Adam speak.
Well, I think you said the phrase preventable tragedies earlier, which is like, I suppose to sort of link it to The Fablemans, that is like the through line of the film, really. And the way I think that Nan and Laura weave in the story of her own family and the preventable tragedies therein is just amazing. And actually, Sophie, I wanted to ask you, seeing the film at Venice with the big audience like you did, I watched this on a kind of link at home, so it was a very different experience. But what was the kind of reaction? What was your reaction when the title of the film was kind of revealed or put into context in the film?
I felt it in my heart. Like, the room didn't gasp or anything, but it is a quiet moment. But it's certainly a, like, it's somehow it just brings everything together in a certain way. Yeah, because it's already a great title, but then you see where it comes from, and it just, like, it hits even more.
Mm. Yeah, not a dry eye in the house. What I observed, it really is, it's such a difficult life that she's lived. There's been so many disappointments. She's had to fight so hard for just as respect as an artist to be taken seriously, and then to live through all of those people, all of your friends dying in the AIDS crisis, and then to have to face a second one within a lifetime. She's dealing with, I think, a kind of an unspeakable level of pain, and that gets channeled into this beautiful art is even more inspiring than The Fablemans, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it is inspiring because she never plays the victim. And this isn't a film where it's like, you know, looking back at a great artist's legacy, like someone you may have heard of or someone's photography you might have seen somewhere in a gallery. And, you know, it's not just kind of like, oh, this was their life, these were their struggles. It's like, it's the story of someone who's continually reinvented themselves and found a purpose. And the fact that, as Sophie said, she's still out there doing it, I mean, it kind of leaves you reflecting on like what the important things are in life and the world, I guess, more generally. And I went to something at the V&A in London recently, and they've got like the Sackler Garden still there, like the name is still there. And, you know,
do they?
Yeah. And they go and they go through the various institutions which have kind of now taken the name off, and they kind of, the film sort of bookended by them doing a protest in MoMA in New York. And it kind of makes you think about those institutions. And I just think Nan's story, aside from like all of the amazing stuff she's captured in her work, and I just think her story as someone who's like continually fought for what she feels is right in the world, and the way she's like always maintained that sense of purpose is like the most inspiring thing about it.
Yeah, and coming back as well to Layla, you said, you know, she narrates it, and I think what's continually awe-inspiring is people use the word all killer no filler, and they're usually using it wrongly. Everything she says is like just incredibly piercing and to the point, and she's so unsentimental. She will say exactly what she wants to say in as few words possible, and that's it, that's done, that's her on the subject. And that somehow makes her story all the more powerful, because you're not drowning in some kind of like excess interpretation. She somehow, for all that she's been through, for all the loss that she's seen and that she carries within her, and she herself like had a near-death experience that was this inciting incident for her starting this activist group, you know, she was prescribed OxyContin and then became addicted to opioids and then nearly died. All this stuff that she personally carries, she still has this incredible like whiplash clarity to the way that she sees things. And that is what I find awe-inspiring, because I think the kind of normal human response to pain is to like languish in it, and you almost get lost in it, and you kind of can't almost see beyond it, like above the parapet of your suffering. And she kind of can. I'm like, that's amazing. But also in a way that intensifies the burden, because she can kind of, she can see the sort of the world around her, the inciting incidents. She can see that like all these people didn't need to die. And she can see that this family, the way that they've conducted their obscene need for profit, that, you know, they have profited from people's deaths. And she can make those links, and she can make that case. And so she, you know, this, and I don't want to just be like, oh, this is all Nan Goldin, because I think, you know, Laura Poitras's storytelling is incredible. And also Nan Goldin herself says that, you know, the reason she's even been able to survive even from like childhood has been friendship and community. And, you know, she obviously has cultivated that around her. But I think she's the organizing principle behind the film. Like Laura Poitras has said that so much of her filmmaking has been about just kind of reflect something of who Nan is and how Nan is. So I think it's just like that personality that she has and that presence that she has is kind of the thing that gives the film its presence.
If our listeners wanted to find out more about Laura and Nan, perhaps in the form of an interview in a trendy independent magazine, where might they go?
Oh, well, now you really asked a head scratch. I'm going to need a moment to consider that. But wait, yeah, gee, now that I think about it, I guess Little White Lies magazine, the most recent one. Say, Layla, what's the cover film for that one?
Oh, well, just some documentary that... got a little bit of Oscar buzz. We don't know where from. Maybe Gwyneth Paltrow and Kate Winslet backed it, who knows. But I mean, it's an amazing thing that you got to speak to Nan Goldin for the magazine, because I think she's revealed a lot in this that she's never really spoken about before, with, you know, things about her family, things about sex work, and, you know, so she's not doing a huge amount of press. So, but I was thrilled that you got some one-on-one time with her.
Oh, Layla, I did, but like, I was incredibly intimidated. I cried before and afterwards, because she is so no bullshit. And it's like, it's not that I think I'm a bullshit person, but like, I've got maybe, there's some killer, but there's certainly a lot of filler. And I'm like, how's that going to go down with Nan? How's Nan going to react to my filler? Probably not well. So it's quite nerve wracking. I don't know. She's just, I think something that immediately after the interview, I was like, oh, of course. Like, to my mind, she's this like a formidable individual. And I was like almost approaching her like a rock star. And the moment I started talking to her and I could feel this like prickliness and guardedness, I was like, no, she's like a very vulnerable person. She's a person who's like worried about her image, because she, you know, she's an outsider artist for all intents and purposes. She's been marginalized by society for all of her life, and you know, she herself doesn't feel like a rock star. She feels like someone who has to be like quite cautious. So yeah, we had a decent conversation, but immediately afterwards I was like, I should have approached that in a totally different way. I should have started it by like really kind of showing her that I understand where she's coming from and her work and stuff. But it's something that's quite easy to do as a consumer of art, even though they're telling a story that reveals how vulnerable they are to you, that they've kind of done something incredible. But yeah, like speaking to her, I was like, no, this is someone whose trust you've really got to earn, and understandably so. So yeah, it was like, I still would advise people to read the interview, because, you know, she's Nan Goldin, she gives good answers. But I wouldn't say it was my finest hour as an interviewer.
Well, I think even your mid-tier is most people's absolute finest hour when it comes to interviewing people. No, and it's an amazing new issue, and I absolutely loved both of your interviews in it. But yeah, let's get some scores on this. I imagine they're going to be pretty good. Adam, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, I think maybe a four in anticipation. I wasn't as familiar with Nan's story, aside from her kind of work. I wasn't really familiar with her involvement in the kind of OxyContin activism, but big fan of Laura. I mean, ever since kind of Citizen Four, her Edward Snowden film, sort of quite keenly followed her career. So probably a four, but then yeah, definitely fives in enjoyment and in retrospect. I think this is like not just a brilliant documentary and a brilliant piece of storytelling, but like a really important film that everyone should see.
Sophie, what about you? Is there such thing as giving a something 17 out of 5?
17s across the board. No, 4. Like I like Laura Poitras, but I had her down as sort of almost quite a cerebral director, quite a sinewy director. And for me, cinema is at its powerhouse best when it's also got this great emotional power to it. So yeah, I was like absolutely blown away. So then it was 4, 17, 17. Or if I must, 4, 5, 5. Lails?
Yeah, I mean, Sophie will know this, but we were kind of working for the same publication at Venice, and we had this very strange thing where we were never in sync. We never liked the same films. And this was one where I have to say, Sophie, I stand corrected. You were completely right. Because, yeah, maybe four in retrospect, I knew Nan Goldin's work and I was interested in that. Three in enjoyment, I thought at the time watching it, I was clearly just exhausted and tired. And I was like, oh, I think this is all a bit much. And I only kind of, I like the Nan Goldin stuff. I'm not so interested in other elements. And I was wrong. Five in retrospect. I've rewatched it twice since. It's absolutely incredible. And I think it's also a very important piece of activism that I think will do a lot of good in the world. And what more can you say about art than that? Next up for Film Club, it's Variety. Christine takes a job selling tickets at a porno theatre near Times Square. Instead of distancing herself from the dark and erotic nature of this milieu, she develops an obsession that begins to consume her life. So, Adam, back in downtown New York, the world of Nan Goldin. Nan Goldin is also in this film. Is this your first time to Variety?
It is, yes. Must admit, this was not a film that's kind of on my radar previously. Or it was a film I'd heard of, but not watched. And yeah, Nan Goldin is very much a sort of more of a kind of background figure, really, and is playing a character called Nan. So I assume she was sort of friends with director Betty Gordon, and I imagine they were popping up in each other's work quite a bit around the time. But it follows this character, this woman called Christine, who is played by Sandy McLeod, who I don't really think acted in much beyond this, but is like a really, I mean, for what is a fairly kind of like lo-fi, scuzzy, you know, New York story, it's like she just completely radiates like star quality and has, I think, a great deal of screen presence. And it's a shame she didn't really go on to do much beyond this. But she plays this character who starts working at a adult theater in New York, just on the kind of front ticket desk. And it follows her initially. She has funny little verbal sparring sessions with Luis Guzman, who a very young, I think his first ever screen role, Luis Guzman, who kind of manages the porn theater. And he's very funny. I mean, makes you wonder if this is the reason PTA cast him in Boogie Nights, because the kind of Luis Guzman, like pornographic cinematic universe, it's kind of expanded out from there. But yeah, he's very funny. And she becomes fascinated in this older male character who appears every so often at the theatre and shows an interest in her. And then, it just follows this kind of very intriguing story of her trying to track him down, essentially, and find out who this kind of mysterious man is. And we never quite do. It's a very kind of ambiguous film. I think you can kind of read a lot into it. And it's one of those films that really has, like, as I said, wasn't really massively on my radar. So I don't know if it has a reputation beyond kind of my sort of ignorance. But it feels like a film which, on the surface, you would think is just a kind of, it's one of those films of the era where it maybe follows a character, but not a lot happens. It's a bit more of a kind of textural thing. But it's actually, like, as a kind of piece of, like, screenwriting, it's a really tight, like, thriller. I mean, there's shades of, like, Brian De Palma in there. Definitely gave me that kind of vibe. But I love, just first and foremost, I just love how it captures this bygone era. You know, if you look at films from that period, particularly this and something like Susan Seidelman's Smithereens, which again is like this great portrait of like the New York punk scene and follows female character. It's like, yeah, it's just a nice kind of time capsule piece, I suppose. And it takes you back to that era where things weren't necessarily better, but they were maybe more interesting.
Yeah, it wasn't a film that got a lot of praise at the time, which seems apt given that like so much of what these downtown artists were doing at the time was not being taken seriously. But Sophie, do you think this is actually kind of a underappreciated masterpiece?
So actually, I saw it at the cinema in 2017. I just looked it up. It was because I saw it at the Barbican, and it was a season called The Grime and the Glamour, and it really made a lasting impression on me. It's got this kind of fever dream quality. It's like a little bit heightened, and it also has the kind of like eroticism, slightly fantastical eroticism of like an Anais Nin story. But also, yeah, it totally does have that Brian De Palma thriller element, and it's got almost like that Scorsese's After Hours, you know, just someone going on this sort of adventure through the New York street nights and like, are they ever going to make it back to themselves? Maybe, maybe not. So yeah, I really, it is very, very atmospheric, and it was great to see at the cinema because it's beautiful in a really scuzzy way. It's like, ooh, the neon lights of downtown New York. So much of it is just, yeah, either in the streets or in the porn theatre where she works, or the bar where Nan Goldin works. I think it's called Tin Pan, and that's where she really did work. And so I think some of that stuff that's filmed there is quite, if not verite, then just riffing on the kind of the real dynamic that would happen all the time. On one level, it is just this woman sort of stepping into this other version of herself. And there are these two like pretty incredible scenes where she's got this quite straight edge boyfriend. He's a journalist, and he'll just ask her a normal question. And apropos of this, she'll just describe in vivid detail, like an erotic scenario. You know, one of them features a woman making love first to a snake and then a tiger. And all the way he'll just be sort of like standing there stony face, and she'll just be like getting more and more into it, you know, just really laying on the detail. And in that particular scenario where she's describing having sex with, like, this situation where a woman has sex with a tiger, he's playing pinball. And there's just something about the combination of like a man being told a like fantastical erotic short story and him also just like very focusedly playing pinball that is just like absurdly brilliant. And so yeah, there'll be like long stretches that are quite dialogue free and that are just observing her living her life in New York, but then there'll be, you know, these kind of like quite surreal exchanges. And I think Nan Goldin functions within it almost as like the kind of mother superior of the gutter or something. Like, you know, she's just there, like, she's caring, she's just, you know, leaving messages on Christine's answer phone and being like, dude, are you okay? So yeah, it's like, yeah, it's just like I think it's like quite a fever dream type film, and it's, yeah, it's just very, very atmospheric. And I think it does have some cult standing. Like, I know, like, you know, it played at the Barbican, but I know it also plays at repertory cinemas in New York sometimes, so I think it's like a sort of countercultural gem.
Yeah. Countercultural gem. Let's put that on the poster. That kind of sums it up so brilliantly. But yeah, before we wrap up, we've got our new thing that we do, which is we're going to end with you guys giving us and the listeners some recommendations that aren't movie related. So Sophie, do you want to go first? What is the non-movie thing that you would advise people seek out?
I mean, it's not cheating, but it is movie adjacent in that this is a woman that Adam's already mentioned, who's kind of primarily known for the movies. Sarah Polley's book, Run Towards the Danger. Sarah Polley, who Adam mentioned in connection with her new film, Women Talking. She's actually also an extremely gifted writer. Like, this is a collection of 6 essays, and they're all incredibly visceral in different ways. Like, the first essay is about her being a child who's just lost her mum, who has to wear a, like, full-body brace for her scoliosis. You know, she's got stories about having a high-risk pregnancy. She's got her essay about Me Too is, like, the most interesting and nuanced take I think I've ever read on it, in terms of, like, sort of the way that trauma impacts women and their ability to tell stories, and how actually something that's often used against women who are testifying against men is the fact, like, oh, like, you were really friendly with him afterwards. But this kind of unpicks that kind of survival strategy. Anyway, like, they're, you know, they're not all about, like, visceral bodily things, but, like, 3 of them are, and they're all just really, really well written. And she's just such a thoughtful writer as well. Like, there are no hot takes in there. And in fact, like, one of the things that's kind of great about this book, and she says it in the introduction, is like, what happens to you as you go along actually shapes how you remember things. So, like, your perception of events in your past are not static. I love that. And it's, yeah, it's just this incredible fluidity that she brings to the way she tells the story, this reflectiveness. You feel this, yeah, like, this sense of, I think I keep using the word life force in things I really respond to. Like, that's what I responded to so much in All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. Because I think it's one of the hardest things to capture, you know. We want to nail things down. And the greatest artists accept that that's absolutely, truly impossible. And yeah, Run Towards the Danger is like, it's just got this life force, and it's very thoughtful, and it's super interesting. And I just read it so fast. So that's what I recommend.
Well, I'm genuinely going to run out the second this is over and get that. Adam, what about you?
Am I allowed to?
Sure.
Well, the first one is an exhibition I went to a couple of weeks ago at the Photographers Gallery in London, which is a retrospective of the British photographer Chris Killip. And he primarily worked in the kind of late 70s, early 80s in the north of England, and sort of embedded himself in communities that were sort of on the margins of society, on the fringes of society. And he produces these amazing, like, very stark but very beautiful and very kind of sympathetic portraits of people. And that's like a very good cheapish exhibition. I think it's on for another couple of weeks. And then the other thing was, I just saw actually, like, shortly before we started recording, anyone who is a fan of the band Bikini Kill. So Kathleen Hanna, on the subject of, like, punk feminist icons, is one of the founders of that, and her other band La Tigra are going on tour later this year for the first time in, I think, like 18 years. And I believe tickets go on sale on Friday, so by the time this goes out, listeners should be able to purchase them. But yeah, they're a good band. So I'll be in the queue trying to get tickets for that.
God, I love this new feature. I feel like I should do some sort of thought experiment where I take up every single recommendation and then, like, start a blog of channeling my journey of self-discovery through all of these. But yeah, thank you both very much. If you've got thoughts on these films, email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's a bumper episode where we'll be announcing a couple of very exciting new changes. And to kick it off, two of the biggest and most exciting directors in Hollywood will be joining us. We'll also be talking about When Motherhood Proves a Nightmare in Alice Diop's masterful Saint-Omer, which was robbed in the recent Oscar nominations. The Renaissance is on in Aronofsky's The Whale. M. Night Shyamalan is answering a knock at the cabin, and the film club, a young Senegalese woman faces tragedy in Ousmane Sembène's 1969 masterpiece, Black Girl. God, that is, what a great week. Thanks so much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Adam Woodward and Sophie Muntz-Kaufman. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.